Israeli forces killed three young Palestinians in a raid on a refugee camp near the occupied West Bank city of Nablus. Condemnations pour in from countries and international organizations after an Israeli far-right minister storms the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound. Also coming up, Greece's ruling party wins the country's parliamentary elections but falls short of the majority needed to form a government on its own. Thank you for joining us. We're going to start this broadcast with some breaking news reaching us. Israeli forces have fatally shot three young Palestinian men during a raid on a refugee camp in the occupied West Bank. The Palestinian Health Ministry has been quoted as saying that the three Palestinians were killed in the Balata camp east of the occupied city of Nablus. Local sources say Israeli forces resorted to live rounds while storming the camp, as well as preventing ambulances and medics from entering the area. The regime has stepped up its crackdown against Palestinians since the formation of a new far-right cabinet under Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. More than 140 Palestinians have been killed in the West Bank this year so far. Meanwhile, a far-right Israeli minister's visit to the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound, as well as his provocative rhetoric about the holy site, have sparked a barrage of condemnations. The Arab League said the move represented a dangerous escalation, urging the international community to help end the regime's aggression against Palestinians. Ahmed Majdalani, the Palestinian Minister of Social Development, warned that such incursions would lead to an uncontrollable religious conflict. The resistance movement Hamas described the intrusion as barbaric, saying the regime would bear responsibility for its actions. The United States called the visit provocative, saying the holy place should not be used for political purposes. On Sunday, Etamar Ben-Gvir, backed by troops, broke into Islam's third holiest site for the second time since taking office. He also claimed Israel's ownership of the compound. Recently, Israeli settlers and forces have intensified their incursions into Al-Aqsa. Earlier, we took a close look at the latest Israeli incursion into Al-Aqsa Mosque in our news review program. Let's see what our guests had to say.
I'm inviting two guests to discuss this a bit. So Mazen Gomsia, a Palestinian scientist and author, is joining me from London. Also with us is Charlotte Cates. She's with the Samidun Palestinian Prisoner Society Solidarity Network in Vancouver. Good to see you both. So, Mr. Gomsia, regarding the timing, it's only a few days that we had this Israeli aggression against Gaza Strip and, you know, the mediation, and then came the ceasefire, and now again we have this Mr. Ben-Gvir, then, you know, walking contentedly there and, you know, claiming possession over the area and all that. So what's the purpose of such acts that Palestinians strongly find to be provocative?
Well, Ben-Gvir is very much interested in throwing fuel on the fire, so to speak. It's always been his agenda. He's getting frustrated that the Palestinian resistance is doing calculated moves and not reactionary moves, and he wants to provoke a reactionary move. But he is failing at what he is intending to do. And I would say he represents the Israeli government more than Netanyahu these days among the Israeli public. More Israeli public figures are in government are looking to Ben-Gvir as leadership, basically, rather than looking to him as some fringe individual.
Mm-hmm. Charlotte, if such actions take place again and such visits, and sometimes they turn into storming into the holy site, What could the consequences be?
Well, it's obvious that what Ben-Gvir and his government are trying to do is exactly what our fellow guest just said, which is they want to reclaim the initiative from the Palestinian resistance. Mm-hmm. The reality is that more and more people around the world quite clearly see who is responsible for what is taking place in Palestine and has been responsible for the past 75 years and beyond, and that's the Zionist project. And so we could see responses from the Palestinian resistance in the West Bank, in Jerusalem, in Gaza, and elsewhere. We could see broader international efforts to isolate this illegitimate Zionist regime and hold it accountable for its crimes. We can see a growing popular anger, not only inside occupied Palestine, but among Muslims around the world, at this ongoing violation and desecration of a holy site. But what it's clear is that these kinds of attempts are not going to take back the power of initiative from the Palestinian resistance. What happened just last week in the Battle of the Revenge of the Free made that very clear. And so none of Ben-Gvir's provocations are going to succeed either in obtaining control of Al-Aqsa or in reclaiming the initiative or reclaiming the power of deterrence for the Zionist project.
Thank you so much for that. Mazen Gomsi in London, Charlotte Cates in Vancouver.
Now, the Iraqi national team withdraws from the World Fencing Championship in Turkey after finding out they would be competing against Israel. In a statement, the Iraqi Fencing Federation said the decision was made, quote, in rejection of the occupying Israeli entity and in solidarity with the Palestinian cause. The move also complies with a legislation passed by the Iraqi parliament in May 2020, criminalizing normalization with the regime. On Friday, a Kuwaiti fencer also withdrew from the games in Turkey to avoid facing an Israeli contestant. The fencer said he made the decision to express support for the Palestinian cause and refusal of normalization with Israel. The Lebanese resistance movement Hezbollah has conducted a military drill in southern Lebanon. As our correspondent Mariam Saleh reports, the drill simulated an operation repelling an Israeli invasion of Lebanon.
Commemorate the 23rd anniversary of the liberation of South Lebanon from Israeli occupation, Hezbollah conducted an unprecedented live military drill in the South Lebanese town of Aramta. After a show of hand-to-hand combat and a parade of all-terrain vehicles and motorcycles, the fighters launched a simulation of taking over an Israeli post in the occupied Galilee area. Over 100 media outlets covered the event, which many say is something unseen since before the liberation in 2000.
The location chosen for this is quite telling. First of all, it's close to the border with Israel. And, of course, this area back in before 2000 was under Israeli occupation. The old Bir Kalab outpost the Israelis had was just up on the hill behind us. So this is very familiar territory for Hezbollah.
The head of Hezbollah's executive council, Sayyid Hashem Safieddine, warned Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu that his cabinet will not be able to change the rules of engagement.
Our message to Israel is clear. If you think that you can launch a full-scale aggression in order to strike the equations of deterrence, which we made with our blood and armaments and strength, we will be ready to shower you with precise rockets, and you will witness black days unlike any other. The Israeli regime knows what we mean. We will use our precise rockets and all means available to us.
Observers see that Hezbollah is primarily seeking psychological warfare against Israel with this maneuver.
But clearly the message is towards the Israelis primarily. As we've seen with the recent escalation in Gaza, we've seen a tightening of the ties, the military ties between Hezbollah, Hamas, Islamic Jihad, and so on. So I think this show today feeds into that.
Hezbollah says the drill sent a message to the Israeli regime about the readiness of the resistance to deter enemy aggression and defend Lebanon. Israeli forces left most of southern Lebanon on May 25, 2000, after 22 years of occupation. Hezbollah's military drill is not merely a show of force, with prospects of a possible confrontation and continuous Israeli aggressions towards Al-Quds. Hezbollah wants to send a clear message to the Israelis that its deterrence capabilities remain intact. Mariam Saleh, South Lebanon.
Turning elsewhere now, an official ceremony has been held in the southern Iranian port city of Bandar Abbas to welcome the arrival of a naval flotilla back home after a successful journey around the world. The ceremony was attended by top military commanders, including the Chief of General Staff of the Iranian Armed Forces. Major General Mohammad Baqari said at the ceremony that the expedition marks the beginning of a new chapter in the growth of Iran's naval power. The general added that the mission is a unique achievement for a navy subject to sanctions and other propaganda and pressure. The flotilla comprised the domestically manufactured Dina, the destroyer, and the Macron forward base ship. They entered Iranian waters on May 17. The flotilla completed its 63,000-kilometer journey around the world in 8 months. It marked the first time an Iranian naval group entered the Pacific. The vessel sailed to South America and visited South Africa before returning home. We were earlier joined by our correspondent Gisu Misha Ahmedi, who gave us more details about the flotilla's unique world voyage. Let's take a listen to what she has to say.
I am at the port city of Bandar Abbas in the south of Iran. The 86th flotilla is back from its round-the-world trip, a very specific and special experience for the Iranian Navy. Let's mention that not all navies in the world have this type of experience, touring the entire world, traveling through all the major oceans, the Pacific, the Atlantic, the Indian Ocean, some very dangerous maritime routes that they've passed, and, of course, this is all done because of the technical development of the Iranian Navy, the fact that it has acquired state-of-the-art know-how and technology in order to be able to carry out such an important and dangerous, in many cases, mission that not all navies, as I mentioned before, would be able to take on, traveling through all the important and major canals in the world. And, of course, let's also point out to the fact that this was done because of an atmospherology software that was developed by Iranian technicians. Now, to find out more about the technical aspects and the major developments in this field, I am joined by the technical commander of the Iranian Navy, who is joining me right now to tell us more about this.
The all-Iranian Dina destroyer and the Macron forward-based ship are the result of round-the-clock efforts by technical experts at the Iranian Navy and the Defense Ministry, and they managed to pass through all this long route. It is almost 60,000 kilometers they sailed across that route, and that suggests the technical progress of our youth. With the help of this software, we were able to predict what would happen in the seas, and this was one of the secrets to our success, and we knew what we were supposed to do.
Iran's foreign ministry has summoned the Swiss ambassador to Tehran over interference in the country's internal affairs. The ministry also strongly protested against what it called an unconventional and unprofessional move by the Swiss embassy to publish a false representation of the Iranian flag. Tehran emphasized that such moves are not in keeping with the friendly relations between the two countries and must be corrected. The ambassador promised to convey Iran's message to her country. Earlier, the Swiss embassy shared a social media post criticizing Iran's execution of three men who had been convicted of terrorism. The post included an image of the former Iranian regime's flag. Greek Prime Minister Kyriakos Mitsotakis says his Conservative Party unleashed a, quote, political earthquake with a thumping victory in Sunday's parliamentary elections. Mitsotakis said, however, that he would seek a new ballot to enable his party to secure an absolute majority to govern alone. with just over 82% of the votes counted. New Democracy Party was in commanding lead of nearly 41%. The radical Syriza Party of Alexis Tsipras was trailing far behind with just over 20% of the ballots. Despite the clear win, the Conservatives were short of a few seats for an outright majority, meaning that Mr. Takis would either form a coalition government or opt for a new ballot to get a decisive result. Well, that brings an end to our bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
Bustle of life. The sound of living. Only sound will endure.
Hello.
IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The Nakba didn't end in 1948. It continues to impact the Palestinians daily. Nakba Day serves as a reminder that until there is an end to the Zionist regime's occupation, there can be no hope for peace. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for the first part, please. Truth Out noted, 75 years ago, the fabricated regime of Israel was established and the Palestinian state of despair and homelessness began. Palestinians refer to this day as An-Nakba, the catastrophe that resulted in the ethnic cleansing of nearly 750,000 natives and the destruction of more than 500 Palestinian villages and towns. May 15, 1948 is a date forever etched in the collective memory of every Palestinian. No one can forget what happened in the lead-up to that fateful day. During that time, the world witnessed one of the largest forced migrations in modern history. Today, the fabricated regime of Israel's founding strategy of the forced removal of the indigenous population continues. For decades, Palestinians have been prevented from exercising their rights to freedom, equality, and self-determination. For decades, they have endured horrific conditions of apartheid and brutal military occupation. And after decades, the hope of recovering even a small portion of their historic homeland has slipped away. Palestinians know that with the newly elected extremist far-right government, the worst is yet to come. We'll be right back. Palestinians continue to suffer daily abuses under the Zionist regime's apartheid and its most inhuman form of collective punishment, while the United States government remains tacitly supportive of Israel's human rights violations, crimes against humanity, and its ongoing oppression of Palestinians. In its latest bombardments that killed 34 people, including 6 children, in Gaza, the Zionist regime did not exercise its right to self-defense, as some of American elected officials and the mainstream media outlets would have you believe. It has committed mass murder and war crimes. It utilized its military might, one of the world's most dangerously equipped army, air force, and navy, with a large nuclear arsenal, against an occupied, crowded population under a suffocating siege for more than 15 years. During the last decade and a half, the Zionist regime bombed Gaza 8 times, each time causing death, destruction, and a human tragedy of unimaginable proportions. Each time, the Zionist regime's indiscriminate and criminal bombardment ended with a short-lived ceasefire, leaving the people of Gaza to live their lives in daily fear of the next round of aerial bombardment and missiles that could destroy their homes and rip their families apart. Just because the terror from the sky temporarily halted does not mean that the terror on the ground has ended. What is worse than dying in Gaza is living in Gaza. The dire humanitarian conditions in Gaza, coupled with shortages of food, electricity, fuel, and medical supplies, are leaving Palestinians without life-sustaining goods and services, with endless misery and hardship. The atrocities that occurred recently, the attacks on worshippers at the Al-Aqsa Mosque that injured hundreds, the systematic raids on Jenin and Nablus that killed scores of civilians, the demolition of a school, and threat of expulsion faced by more than 1,000 Palestinians after the Zionist regime's high court approved the razing of several villages in Masafer Yatta in Al-Khalil Hills, are only the latest in a series of crimes against humanity that Israel has committed since its inception. The ensuing Palestinian uproar over these crimes reflects pent-up rage against apartheid, racism, persecution, deadly force, and occupation. The rightful outcry also condemns inaction from the international community, especially the U.S., to hold the Zionist regime accountable for its violations of international and human rights laws. Palestinians the world over will never forget the assassination of Palestinian-American journalist Shirin Abu Aghla 1 year ago. Her murder by Israeli forces, IDF, with a sniper bullet to the face, while clearly wearing a press vest, shook people around the world. Dedicating her life to reporting the truth and exposing the horrors of ongoing Israeli occupation, Abu Aghla represents the best Palestine and humanity has ever produced. A new report from the Committee to Protect Journalists, released recently to coincide with the anniversary of Abu Aghla's death, found that since 2001, the Zionist regime has never charged or held anyone accountable for killing of at least 20 journalists, 18 of whom were Palestinian. Since taking office, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has moved quickly together with his racist, far-right, anti-Palestinian partners to implement new policies that have escalated the violence. These new policies include intensified military raids and targeted assassinations of so-called terrorists, stepped-up demolitions of Palestinian homes, and the expansion of illegal Israeli regime settlements on stolen Palestinian land. It's quite alarming to think that the Zionist regime's systematic oppression of Palestinians and its denial of Palestinian rights is about to get even worse. How much worse can it get? Also, Crescent International wrote in this regard, as most of the world recoils in horror, watching deliberately calculated Israeli regime brutality and cold-blooded killing of Palestinians, many who are outraged would be asking, when will Zionist-led programs end? After all, Palestinians have for decades now faced the savagery of Zionist policies by Israeli thugs who masquerade as leaders of a mythical regime. The tragedy that befell Palestine during the period leading up to 1948 and beyond, resulting in the displacement and dispossession of millions of Palestinians, is defined as Nakba or catastrophe. Today, 75 years later, while atrocities against Palestinians continue unabated and with impunity, it is scandalous that some people see it fit to celebrate settler colonialism, which possesses all the hallmarks of genocide. Zionism, an ideology rooted in racism and apartheid, has been and remains at the core of the Zionist regime's political-military suppression of fundamental human rights. Responsible for atrocious war crimes and the imposition of Jewish supremacism, Zionist Israel not only disregards global conventions, but arrogantly defies it. Indeed, decades of defiance of the United Nations Charter on Human Rights, as well as a violation of the provisions of the Geneva Convention, have been enabled by the protection the Zionist regime unjustly enjoys courtesy the United States of America.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
Viewpoints.
With the presence of different scholars.
The presence of different scholars. IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners. This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to the program of Viewpoints. I am Bita, the host of today's episode, and here with me there are two dear guest speakers, Brother Ali and Brother Hassanin. Assalamu alaikum, brothers.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
So, as you know, we talked about one of the most important essential issues of the Islamic world, about the condition of Palestinian people in Palestine. We had several programs in this viewpoint, I don't know, about the struggles, the problems, the issues that these kind of Palestinian people are going through. And also, we talked about why we have to help these kind of people in need and what are the responsibilities of Islamic Ummah in these issues. So, in today's episode, we're going to talk about some special point of view and dimension of this issue and the lessons, you know, the things that we can learn from all these dramas, these kind of accidents and incidents, and these sufferings. You mentioned some important facts, but I think here, the main reason not negotiating with these people is that, you know, when you negotiate with someone, you expect them to understand you, to have some standards of, I don't know, of human, of being human. But I think this is not true about Israel and all of its power and so on. And you mentioned something else, that they fight back Israel Israel, and they are powerful, of course, for sure Palestinian people are powerful, and we have to learn this power as a lesson of this issue. But I want you to elaborate this power of Palestinian people for us more, Brother Ali.
I want to actually collect between this question of yours and the previous one to add one more lesson, which even answers the this late question of yours as well. It was quite common between the, let's say, neighboring countries of Israel that Israel is a power that will never defeat.
Yeah.
So Palestinians and the resistance line showed that this hegemonic power is defeatable, and the signs of which was seen in the defeat of the south of Lebanon in 2003 and 2013, I think, if I'm not sure about the date. It was 2013 or 2003.
Yeah.
So it was quite astonishing for the world that Israel defeated from a small group of, let's say, were defeated by a small military group, I mean, or militia, called Hezbollah. So for Palestinians themselves, it was very beautiful. Okay, so it's not it is not that unbreakable that they were thinking. So this power can be broken. And later, slowly, people understood that this resistance line should be strengthened. And they did so. And they found themselves, and they found this courage to confront with them in their own land. We see in the history of Palestine and confrontations that they had with Palestinians, too many times they attacked Gaza. But the last time, whenever they attacked Gaza, they received a good answer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it was not like before. What was the beginning of this story? It was at the time that they have been defeated and the kind of repulsion that they had at the time of war with Hezbollah. So this actually, it injected a sort of energy inside the hearts and souls of Palestinians and even all Islam world that this Israel is not the Israel that they were thinking. And those illusions of having an hegemonic power that will never defend, and it is backed by a superpower like America or even NATO.
Yeah.
So they are all in vain. I mean, it is as if this, what really, in the real sense, Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah actually called it the Bayt an awhan al buyut la Bayt al Ankabut. He said Israel is the Bayt al Ankabut, the house of spider, the house of spider. Today.
Yeah, thank you for your elaboration. So we come to this point that we can see these differences in Israel, and we can interpret all these improvements as victory. Mm-hmm. And I think one of the reasons of this victory is the unity of the people of Palestine. They are together for one special goal, for one special religion, for the values that share with each other. And this is the unity that we have to learn after. And Brother Hassanin, I want you to elaborate this part more for us, this lesson special.
You know, this unity, where does this unity derive from? And also, as mentioned in the book, the Palestine, in the book, Ayatollah Khamenei says, the main power of the Palestinian people is their faith.
Mm.
So the threat posed by, I'm quoting Rahba, the threat posed by each selfless Palestinian youth is as great as a threat posed by an army. So this is not the battle between the Palestinian nation. It is not the battle between two armies.
Yeah.
So it is not right to say that one side has more tanks than the other. It is a battle by bodies and souls of people who are not afraid of death. So each selfless youth that is fighting the uprising regime poses as much threat to the Zionist as an army would. So it is not possible to confront such youths with tank who are not feared of death.
Yeah.
So this people fighting for their religion, for their national interest, and for their faith, this is really great thing. It's a big thing.
Yeah.
So, you know, this keeps people together. Yeah. And so this is not possible for an army to fight with tanks to the people who are not afraid of death.
Definitely.
Yeah.
I want to add one more comment to the explanations of Brother Hassanin. We have seen and witnessed again that the peace talks caused division among the Palestinian groups, because we saw a group of them were all a group of them disagreed with that, and a small group of them agreed with the peace talks, and they accepted all the conditions, specifically in the Oslo plan and Oslo Oslo talks, I can call it. So when they came for the second intifada, actually, when they gathered all together, and even a part of the government, Palestinian government, who was in favor of peace talks, even showed them a positive light, a green light. So even they came to agree with the majority of the groups, they saw the result of it. I mean, I can call it the defeat of Israel inside his house, its house.
So it was basically a trap.
So I want to say for all the Muslim countries, not only for Palestine, for all Muslim countries, we want to actually take this lesson again. That peace talks, when you are going to just be a receiver of conditions, will never work. At times that you have no power and you are sitting there and they are going to dictate some conditions on you, it will never end. I mean, it will never reach you to any conclusion. So when you want to take back your right, you have to do something. We have seen that peace with, let's say, a wild wolf doesn't have any meaning. It's as if you're in the jungle and you say, okay, I'll go and negotiate with this wolf and I'll ask him not to eat me up. So it's meaningless. The same issue, I think, had happened in reality. In Oslo talks, one side was dictating the orders to the other one, and the other one was only the receiver of the orders.
It doesn't make sense, like being peace talks. It's just one power imposing on the inferior group.
Definitely. So we have seen the result of it and the fruit of it in the Second Intifada. All of the Palestinian groups came together. It was Hamas, it was Jihad, it was even a part of Fatah. They came together and they became one. When they became one, Israel become nothing. So it can be repeated again. Alhamdulillah, we are seeing even this strategy is still alive, but it needs to be, I think, comprehensive and all parts of the Palestinian land these days.
So, for sure, these kind of lessons are so invaluable for us, you know, because they came from the suffering and pain and the bloodshed of a people that they were being oppressed by the people who think they are superior, but they're not, actually. And the thing I want to ask you is that we all know that these lessons exist that we can learn, and also they are so invaluable because they came from the life of the people. But are we exactly practically in practically going through these lessons? I mean, how about the Islamic Ummah? Are they using these lessons, or are they just talking about it and they don't make it real? You know, what do you think about the reaction of Islamic Ummah to this lesson?
It depends. It's a wide statement, actually. You know, supporting the truth and supporting the haqq, you know, we say like, everyone just, you know, they would love to say that, you know, I stand with the truth.
Exactly.
You see, all the Muslims around the world. But then it comes to a discussion, then it's a question of debate. Like, how many people are actually, you know, working according to their quotes? Like, whatever they're saying, like, how many people are acting according to their words? So we see, it's good that it's a positive side that we get to see on the social media that, you know, people from different countries and the different religious scholars, like be it Shia, be it Sunni, they, you know, they present this issue on a bigger stage. You know, it may be the pulpits and all, like in the religious gatherings. So these issues are to be mentioned. So this shows, like, you know, people being, you know, in their home countries, and they're showing their support from their home countries. So, yeah, there's efforts that are being made.
Exactly.
And some people just say, but they don't act on it.
Yeah, thank you. And Brother Ali?
Yeah, I want to say that most of Islamic countries, I want to differentiate between Islamic countries and Islamic communities.
Ahsan, that's a very good differentiation.
Yeah. Islamic communities and Islamic countries are two different issues. Muslim ummah differs with the Muslim leaders.
Right.
Unfortunately, in the Islamic countries, the leaders did not have a good test, and they have to be respondent in the divine court of justice, inshallah, in the day of judgment, what they have done with regard to the issue of Palestine. Mm-hmm. They did not do well. Because based on Islamic rulings and Islamic laws, we are, all of us are responsible for whatever is happening in the Islam world first. And mm-hmm. even not only in Islam world, wherever an oppressor mm-hmm. is oppressing anybody,
yeah.
whether it be it a Muslim or non-Muslim, we are responsible. So what did they do? Did they, criticize Palestine? Have they ever criticized Israel or stood in front of Israel or took any stance in front of Israel? But we rarely see such thing. Unfortunately, very, very, very sad, to say that they even went to normalize their relationships, to normalize their relations with Israel, and they did normalization.
Unfortunately, stance is not usually to be seen from the officials and the governments of
very
the Islamic
true,
countries.
Very true. So I want to say that the Islamic leaders did very bad. But Muslim Ummah, no. If you want to check the Muslim Ummah, go to Hajj and ask them. Every single Muslim that goes there, ask them, do you agree with your leaders that they have done so? They definitely tell you no.
Yeah.
This is what I myself did it. I asked. And I received this almost 90 plus
yeah.
percent of the Islamic Ummah. Yeah. They disagree with whatever the leaders are doing. So who agrees that, for example, to have a relation with the one who is killing my sister and brother? Mm-hmm. So as for this, but it's never late.
No.
Okay. Yeah. Sorry. You can interrupt me whenever.
Yeah. Thank you very much for being here on this episode with me. For sure, there are many lessons that we didn't mention in this episode that we can learn from this beautiful scene that we're watching. And we're going to discuss it more in the later episodes. Thank you for listening, dear listeners. Hope you actually be showered with the blessings of Allah. And assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullahi.
Every day we tell each other that this day will be the last, and tomorrow we all can go home free, and all this will finally end. Palestine, tomorrow will be free. Palestine, tomorrow will be free. Father, to wipe away my tears, that's why I will cry. I feel scared, but I won't show my fears. I keep my head high, deep in my heart, I never have any doubt. The Palestine, tomorrow will be free. Palestine, tomorrow will be free.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Limelight.
The Republican Party has lost contact with nearly all of the whistleblowers in their ongoing investigation into President Joe Biden. Marjorie Taylor Greene confirmed on Monday, 15th of May. We take a look at the U.S. media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The American newspaper The Daily Beast has covered this story and tells us more. The Republican Party has lost contact with nearly all of the whistleblowers in their ongoing investigation into President Joe Biden, Marjorie Taylor Greene confirmed on Monday, 15th of May. According to the Georgia Republican, most of the informants are missing in action, except for one. That whistleblower is very safe, Marjorie Taylor Greene told Steve Bannon on his War Room podcast. But he does fear for his life, and rightfully so. While Greene claims to be in touch with that one witness, the same can't be said for up to nine others. That whistleblower came through for us, thankfully, through the help of Senator Grassley, she said. But other whistleblowers, yes, they are missing, either in jail or we cannot talk to them at this time because they cannot be found. And our investigation is so important, Steve, that this will bring down the President of the United States, Marjorie Taylor Greene added. Taylor Greene's explanation comes after Representative James Comer, Republican of Kentucky, told Fox News Channel on Sunday that they'd lost contact with at least one key informant. The national broadcaster CNN Cable News Network has also covered this story. An IRS whistleblower who claims to have information about alleged mishandling and political interference in the ongoing criminal probe into Hunter Biden has been removed from the investigation into the president's son. Attorneys for the whistleblower have told key congressional lawmakers. Attorneys for the whistleblower sent a letter on Monday, 15th of May, to a series of House and Senate committee chairmen informing them of the change, adding that the whistleblower's investigative team has also been taken off the case, according to a copy of the letter obtained by CNN. The attorneys, including Tristan Leavitt, president of Empower Oversight, and Mark Little, added that the whistleblower was informed the change was at the request of the Department of Justice. The letter states that it is an investigation of a high-profile controversial subject, which sources familiar with the matter have previously confirmed to CNN was President's son, Hunter Biden. Federal prosecutors have spent years spanning three attorney general investigating Hunter Biden and have weighed bringing charges against him for alleged tax crimes and a false statement. So far, no charges have been filed. Hunter Biden has denied any wrongdoing. In a statement on Tuesday, 16th of May, the IRS declined to comment on a specific taxpayer matter. In general, the IRS, the Inland Revenue Service, is deeply committed to protecting the role of whistleblowers, and there are robust processes and procedures in place to protect whistleblowers. An IRS commissioner, Danny Werfel, has stated, "We will not tolerate retaliation against any IRS employee making a whistleblower allegation. When suggestions of wrongdoing are raised, we work with all appropriate parties, including the Treasury Inspector General for Tax Administration, to ensure the integrity of the whistleblower process is safeguarded," according to the IRS statement. The department cannot comment on the matter, a Justice Department spokesperson said. As to any investigation of Hunter Biden, as the Attorney General has said, that investigation is being handled by U.S. Attorney David Weiss, who has full authority to make investigative decisions and to bring charges in any jurisdiction as he deems appropriate. An attorney for the IRS whistleblower didn't immediately respond to a request for comment. A spokesman for the U.S. Attorney's Office in Delaware, the office conducting the Hunter Biden criminal probe, declined to comment. White House spokesman Ian Sams previously said that President Biden has made clear that this matter would be handled independently by the Justice Department under the leadership of a U.S. attorney appointed by former President Trump, free from any political interference by the White House. He has upheld that commitment. Representative Richard Neal, the top Democrat on the House Ways and Means Committee, said in a statement, "Ways and Means Democrats take whistleblowers and their protection seriously. More detail is needed here, and we call on Commissioner Werfel to provide the necessary context before making any further judgment," the statement said. The attorneys, Tristan Leavitt and Mark Little, claim in their letter that the move is clearly retaliatory and may also constitute obstruction of a congressional inquiry, a claim that stands in contrast to testimony made by IRS Commissioner Daniel Werfel in April, when he told the House Ways and Means Committee that, "I can say without any hesitation, there will be no retaliation for anyone making an allegation or a call to a whistleblower hotline." The attorney is right that given the agent has successfully sought whistleblower protection, he's protected from retaliatory personnel actions, and that any attempt by any government official to prevent a federal employee from furnishing information to Congress is also a direct violation of long-standing appropriations restriction, and that it is a crime to obstruct an investigation of Congress. The move to sideline the whistleblower and his investigative team comes months after some agents complained that they were no longer being included in some discussions about the case, in part because of alleged leaks, people familiar with the matter told CNN. The investigative work on the case is largely over, and the case awaits charging decision by U.S. Attorney David Weiss, a Donald Trump appointee who is overseeing the probe. The dispute is also not common in fights between Congress and the executive branch of the government over whistleblower complaints. There is no indication the agent in question has lost their job at the IRS. The letter was sent to Democratic and Republican chairmen, as well as the ranking members of the Senate Finance and Judiciary Committees and the House Ways and Means and Judiciary Committees. Attorneys Leavitt and Little asked the committee leaders to give the matter their prompt attention. Republicans and the House Ways and Means Committee confirmed receipt of the letter to CNN, adding in a statement that the most recent communication concerning allegations of retaliatory actions against the whistleblower appears to contradict the sworn testimony by Commissioner Werfel, who pledged that whistleblower protections would be upheld. Congress's duty to hold government agencies accountable relies on the availability and willingness of individuals to speak out about wrongdoing. Not only does retaliation like this discourage whistleblowers, it can also rise to the level of an illegal violation of statutory protections for whistleblowers, the statement continued. CNN has previously reported that the IRS whistleblower alleges that Weiss' ability to bring charges in the case involving Hunter Biden is being thwarted by political appointees. That would contradict promises by Attorney General Merrick Garland in congressional testimony that Attorney Weiss, a Donald Trump appointee, has full authority to make final decisions on whether to prosecute the president's son, Hunter Biden. The IRS whistleblower also claimed to have information that contradicts sworn testimony to Congress by a senior political appointee, according to a previous letter from his attorney. That senior political appointee was Attorney General Merrick Garland. People familiar with the matter have confirmed to CNN. Time magazine has also covered this story and tells us more. The top Republican on the House Oversight Committee clarified on Monday that an informant the committee has lost touch with isn't related to the committee's demand that the FBI hand over internal investigative notes about President Joe Biden. House Oversight Chair James Comer is leading an investigation of overseas business transactions by companies he alleges benefited Biden's relatives during and shortly after the years that Biden was vice president. James Comer has so far failed to show how Biden may have benefited from the payments or how any alleged business dealings by relatives may have impacted Biden's policy decisions. He has repeatedly blamed stonewalling by the Biden administration for why his investigation hasn't gotten more traction. Then on Sunday, James Comer made the unusual disclosure to Fox News Channel that his office has lost touch with an informant in the investigation. "Well, unfortunately, we can't track down the informant. We're hopeful the informant is still there," Comer said. The remark led to widespread speculation that the missing informant was related to the Oversight Committee's fight with the FBI over handling over internal investigation notes and demands to know what actions, if any, the FBI took to investigate Joe Biden. It also sparked unfounded conspiracy theories online that Biden's allies have intervened to silence the informant. James Comer's office clarified on Monday that the informant he lost touch with is unrelated to the FBI records the committee is requesting. Jessica Collins, communications director for the House Oversight Committee, told Time magazine in an email that the whistleblower, who has come forward about the FBI record, alleged that then-Vice President Joe Biden engaged in a bribery scheme with a foreign national isn't missing. James Comer was referring to another whistleblower regarding the Biden family's influence peddling schemes, Collins wrote.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.